Did Prime Minister Trudeau upstage his Foreign Affairs Minister Chrystia Freeland on the occasion of the recent NATO conference in Brussels? Is Chrystia Freeland under assault from the Prime Minister's office and from within the Canadian foreign affairs establishment? What is the significance of the underreported rocket attack on the Polish consulate in Western Ukraine? Should Russia be condemned for its involvement in Crimea and the Donbass? Is there today a united Ukraine national identity to speak of? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a closer look at Ukraine and how Canadian policy there is being shaped by the Ukrainian ultranationalists 3 years after the overthrow of President Yanukovych in a U.S.-backed coup. We will hear commentary from Moscow-based foreign correspondent John Helmer and from Vancouver-based writer and researcher Roger Annis. On this week's show, Canada and the Ukraine Powder Keg, a conversation with John Helmer and Roger Annis. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 7th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. It is known that about 250 people from Majdal and Katab were kidnapped by Al-Qaeda terrorists last week. Local sources have claimed that many of those dead from the chemical weapons were those from Majdal and Katab. This would suggest that on the eve of upcoming peace negotiations, terrorist forces have once again created a false flag scenario. This bears resemblance to the Ghouta chemical weapons attack in 2013, where the Syrian army was accused of using the weapons of mass destruction on the day that United Nations weapons inspectors arrived in Damascus. Later, in a separate chemical weapon usage allegation, Carla Del Ponte, a UN weapons inspector, said that there was no evidence that the government had committed the atrocity. That comes from the article, "Jumping to Conclusions, Something is Not Adding Up in Idlib Chemical Weapons Attack," by Paul Antonopoulos, posted April 5th, originally appearing at Al-Mazdar News. Journalist Mike Chernovich said Obama's national security advisor, Susan Rice, was identified as the official who requested unmasking of incoming Trump officials. Quote, "The White House counsel's office identified her as the person responsible for the unmasking after examining her document log requests," unquote. Under Obama, unmasking rules were changed, cleared to request and use unmasked NSA intelligence reports were Rice, CIA Director John Brennan, Attorney General Loretta Lynch, among others. Information now known confirms Trump and his associates were spied on. That comes from the article "Dirty Rotten Politics" by Stephen Lendman, posted April 5th. As the enemies of peace continue to pressure a new U.S. president into deeper war commitments overseas, and as Washington's deep state works relentlessly opposing Russian moves in Syria at every turn, the war drums have started again, beating harder than ever now, clamoring for a new U.S.-led attack on Syria. This morning, we saw the familiar theme emerge, and just in time to provide a convenient backdrop to this week's Brussels peace talks and conference on Syria's future. The U.S.-led coalition prepares to make its end run into Syria to retake Raqqa and impose its safe zones in order to partition Syria. More media demonization of the Syrian government appears to be needed by the West. On cue, the multi-billion dollar U.S. and U.K. media machines sprung into overdrive this morning over reports, based primarily from their own activist media outlets, Aleppo Media Center and others embedded in the al-Nusra-dominated terrorist stronghold of Idlib, Syria, alongside their media counterpart, the UK-based Syria Observatory for Human Rights, funded by the UK and EU, are all now claiming that the Syrian and Russian air forces have launched a chemical weapons airstrike killing civilians in Idlib. That comes from the article, Reviving the Chemical Weapons Lie, New U.S.-UK Calls for Regime Change, Military Attack Against Syria, by Patrick Henningsen, posted April 5th, originally appearing at 21st Century Wire. On April 4th, the so-called White Helmets reported that the Syrian Air Force's warplane allegedly used the chemical agent sarin against civilians in the village of Khan Shaykhun in the province of Idlib. According to pro-militant outlets, the attack took place during a series of airstrikes in the area. The Syrian Defense Ministry denied the usage of the chemical agent in the area. Later, the Russian Defense Ministry reported that the Syrian Air Force's airstrike destroyed a warehouse where ammunition dump containing chemical weapons was being produced by militants. The warehouse was reportedly used to produce and store shells containing toxic gas. That comes from the article under the headline, Video, Situation Escalates in Western Syria, posted April 6th, originally appearing at South Front. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
We have supported the support of the NATO mission. We have supported instantly and immediately the sending of trainers to help train up the Ukraine army. We have come out vocally condemning the illegitimate and terribly irresponsible in terms of geopolitics. Unacceptable aggression by Russia against incursion into Ukrainian territory, and we will continue to. As you've highlighted, we have one of the most foremost international experts on Ukraine, Christia Freeland, who's in our caucus, who has been back and forth to Ukraine in regular, full contact with President Poroshenko, and engaging in a very constructive way to ensure that it is seen that Canada is united in its condemnation of Russia's illegitimate actions and our support of Ukraine and Ukrainians.
You just heard comments from July of 2015 from current Prime Minister and then Canadian opposition leader Justin Trudeau with regard to his political party's policy stance on Ukraine and the status of Chrystia Freeland as an authority on the Ukraine situation. It is the matter of Ukraine and Canada's role there that figures prominently in the conversation that follows, which took place on April 1st, just after Chrystia Freeland appeared in front of NATO leaders in Brussels. This discussion also happened about 3 weeks after a rather controversial Ottawa press conference in which Freeland insinuated that the circulation on alternative sites of news of her grandfather being a Nazi collaborator during World War II constituted a deliberate destabilization campaign by Russia. Well, it's been now over 3 years since the Kyiv government was brought down in a U.S.-sponsored coup. And we've seen an ongoing strife that's been taking place throughout the territory we know as of Eastern Ukraine, the Donbass. There was a referendum in Crimea which saw that territory secede from the formal territory of Ukraine. And now we've seen some developments with regard to Canada's interaction with the with Ukraine and increased political enmity between Russia and Canada, especially with the current Foreign Affairs Minister, Chrystia Freeland, and some of the comments that she's made, including her ongoing expressions of criticism of Russia and its alleged annexation of Crimea and the various activities that it's Russia is supposedly fostering in eastern Ukraine. So joining me to talk in more detail about Ukraine and the current situation and Canada's involvement, we're joined on the line by John Helmer, who is the longest continuously serving foreign correspondent in Russia and the only Western journalist to direct his own bureau, independent of single national or commercial ties. Mr. Helmer has also been a professor of political science, of sociology, and of journalism, and an advisor to government heads in Greece, the United States, and Asia. And, of course, John Helmer hosts his own blog, Dances with Bears, at the site johnhelmer.net. And joining me here at the University of Winnipeg's CKUW studio is Roger Annis. He's a retired aerospace worker and a longtime socialist and trade union activist. He writes regularly on topics of social justice and peace and is one of the editors of the newcoldwar.org site. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you, Michael.
Oh, you're welcome, Michael.
Okay, maybe we should just start with a couple of fairly recent developments just in the last month. I know that there was, for example, a major NATO meeting at which Chrystia Freeland has had just released a tweet saying at NATO reiterated that Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea and violence in Donbass will not be tolerated. CAD, it's Canada, stands by Ukraine. And, of course, Freeland also tweeted, in the fight for liberal democracy, Ukraine is ground zero. Ukraine's success is the positive message we must send NATO. And also there was the bombing of a Polish consulate, and it's also that seems to have raised the specter of tensions between Ukraine and Poland. So to help, you know, maybe you could help us put these developments in context. John Helmer, maybe we'll start with you. When you've looking at these recent developments, what does that say moving forward?
There's breaking news. In the old-fashioned days of mass media, this would be considered a scoop, Michael. The scoop is that the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, decided to upstage his brand new foreign minister, making her most important international debut at the NATO foreign ministers meeting in Brussels by making his own statement, Trudeau's own statement, in Ottawa as Freeland took her seat in Brussels. Now, for a prime minister to upstage another minister at such an event is really important. Only nobody noticed in the mainstream media that backed Freeland. What Trudeau basically said was, and I'll quote, Canada has always been one of the handful of countries that has always been ready and capable of stepping up on important missions of participating and of punching well above their weight. That's boilerplate for another meaning. It means that Prime Minister Trudeau is not going to heed the American call to raise Canada's defense budget by double to reach the so-called NATO 2% target. That's also the position at the NATO meeting of Germany and lots of other countries who didn't feel obliged to have to say it. But for Trudeau to upstage Freeland before she opened her mouth in Brussels means something very important. It means the scandal around Freeland, the one she created by lying about the past in the Ukraine, is beginning to have a visible political effect in Ottawa. And the Prime Minister is basically telling Trudeau, tone down and keep your mouth more closely aligned with Canada's national interests. Now, it remains to be seen exactly how this will play out. But so, in addition, go ahead.
Yeah, well, you're based in Moscow. And I mean, is this something that's been circulating within, the major media out there? Or is this just a sort of an insider's appraisal?
It's not yet circulating in Moscow because Canada remains a relatively small part of Russia's picture, international picture, and because there's a relatively limited appetite for micro news in Ottawa, back in Moscow. But what is more visible in Moscow, though not yet in the media, not yet commented on officially by on the Moscow side, is that Trudeau also prevailed on Freeland to back down on Russia as well. So what she also had to say, don't have the quote right in front of me, but what she also told Radio Canada International was, in a direct quote, that she's ready to meet with Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov at an Arctic Affairs Summit. Now, Canada pulled a ministerial downgrade in last week's presidential summit on Arctic issues. So it was not represented by a minister, but by a sub-minister. On the other hand, Freeland has now said, I found the quote, "I believe that Sergei Lavrov will be there and would be a very valuable opportunity for all Arctic countries, very much, including Canada, to talk about our shared interests in the Arctic region. And I would be absolutely prepared to have a bilateral meeting with Sergei Lavrov at the Arctic Council if that works for both of our schedules." Now, that's interesting because she's been obliged by Ottawa, by the Prime Minister, by Ms. Freeland's bosses, to behave more reciprocally, more in a spirit of normal interstate relations, and offer a meeting with Mr. Lavrov if he is ready to meet out of his busy schedule. And here's something else she said that you need to understand with a microscope. She told Radio Canada International she had already had an opportunity to, quote, chat with Lavrov last November on the sidelines of a summit meeting in Lima, Peru. Now, when I reported that last November, Freeland was lying again. What she said in the Canadian media, much publicized to promote herself, was that she'd had a meeting with Putin, had spoken in Russian at some length.
She said the top guy, right? The top
That's
guy
right,
in Russia.
The top yeah. guy. Mr. Lavrov is a nice foreign minister, but he's not the top guy. Freeland said it to mean, so that she would be interpreted to mean, she'd met with Putin. In fact, the Kremlin told me there'd been no such meeting. She was caught out promoting herself, then a junior trade minister, as if she could speak in Russian with the Russian president when she hadn't. An incredible demonstration of ambition and ego, and she was caught out lying. It didn't run in the Canadian press, or it wasn't noticed until recently. Now she's had to back down and say, no, actually, it wasn't the top guy. It was the number two or number three guy. And it wasn't a long discussion in Russian. It was a chat like, hello, how are you? And that was all. So now I haven't had time, and the foreign ministry's closed over the weekend, to see if Mr. Lavrov remembers having a chat with Freeland. But the important thing is Ms. Freeland's backing down. So programs like this and sites like Rogers are making a difference in Ottawa in this particular case.
I want to bring Roger Annis into this discussion because I know, Roger, you've been following Canadian foreign policy with regard to Ukraine with pretty close scrutiny, and Ms. Freeland in particular. As you hear this news, this is pretty much consistent with what a lot of the impressions you've gotten about, growing divisions between Ms. Freeland and the PMO?
It is, but it's also difficult for Canadians to decipher here because the subject of Ukraine has been an extremely delicate one in Canada. For the past 3 years, the government has joined with the United States and the European Union in this very aggressive policy of supporting the new right-wing government in Kiev, in opposing the democratic referendum of the Crimean people who opted out of the new right-wing Ukraine. And rejoined the Russian Federation, really correcting a historical, I think you could say, mistake that was made in the 1950s when Crimea was attached to Ukraine. And then this very cruel war in eastern Ukraine, of which Canadians know very little. They know that Canada is intervening militarily. It has soldiers in Ukraine. But that's about all that the media reports here. And so, as we saw when on March 6th, when Minister Freeland was responded to a question about her maternal grandfather's history as an editor of a pro-German newspaper during World War II, this was the first big tremor, the first big shakeup, I would say, in this across-the-board consensus in media and in the parliament that's supporting the NATO policy in Eastern Europe, the right-wing coup in Ukraine, the threats and the gang up against Russia. And journalists, and certainly the elected members of parliament in Ottawa, are extremely reluctant to counter the narrative of poor, defenseless Ukraine being beaten up and ganged up by Russia. So it's, I think it's going to take a lot more time and reflection, beginning with journalists, because there are serious journalists out there in Canada, even though they're largely quiet on these issues. I don't see this coming into Parliament in any way soon, because I think the level of political intimidation on all of these questions pertaining to the current Ukrainian government and the history, the ultra-nationalist right-wing history that this new Ukrainian government is bringing to the fore. This is a complicated history that journalists are loath to enter into. When they do so in Canada, they come under fierce attack, which was the case with those who wrote about the revelations concerning Minister Freeland's grandfather. So it's early days, but it's extremely important for Canadians, because their government is supporting a war in eastern Ukraine. Let's remind ourselves as we talk here, a grinding, cruel war continues in eastern Ukraine against the people of Donbass. Canada is showing no sign whatever of backing off on that. And of course, the whole international campaign against Russia, which is actually running wild in the United States now with all of the allegations of Russian interference in U.S. politics, it's an extremely explosive political situation. So everyone is walking as if on eggshells. And what John has written about in the past, what he's telling us today, is extremely important. It's going to take some time for this to filter through into the body politic in Canada, across the spectrum, from left to right. It's such a terrible air of intellectual and political intimidation that prevails on all things to do, particularly with Ukraine, but also with Russia.
Now, Roger, I just want to follow up on what you just said. And John, I'll give you a chance to kind of chime in if you've got a comment. But I know that before that March 6th press conference, this information about Chrystia Freeland's grandfather had been circulating for about 2 months, and in the independent press and people like John Helmer. It almost sounds like what you're saying is that on some level there was some, given the loathness that the journalists have in breaching these this topic, that maybe they somehow got a signal that they that it was okay to pursue this this matter, as if that's maybe exposing the very divisions between the PMO and Ms. Freeland that John's talking about.
Yeah. Actually, I'll let John speak on that, because I think he'll have some thoughts on this, the March 6th press conference. And remember, this does date back to John's original report, research and reporting in January, which went entirely unreported, or let's call it ignored in Canada.
If not suppressed.
Yeah, call it suppression. Well, I think what happens in media is not so much that, a journalist sits down, looks at a news story and says, I'm not going to report that, the government won't want this. It's the air of intellectual intimidation, journalistic intimidation, which, kind of forms the conduct. And I'll give one other quick example. This story of the rocket attack on the Polish embassy in western Ukraine, Lutsk, small city of Lutsk, March 29th, entirely unreported in Canada. Poland has closed all of its consulates in Ukraine, and, as John mentioned earlier, it's referenced other attacks against Polish historic sites in Ukraine itself. This is extraordinary. This makes me think of, you know, when wars happen between countries, they start by closing their consulates and embassies. It's extremely important and entirely unreported. And this is just a classic example of the of journalism bowing to all of the political intimidation that surrounds the topic of Ukraine in particular and NATO's conduct in Eastern Europe in general.
John Helmer, you're a journalist. You've interacted with many of these journalists. Your thoughts?
Just quickly, I'll try and cover as much ground as Roger's done. The as best I can tell, the scandal of the March 6 press conference that Ms. Freeland gave in the lobby of the House of Commons in Ottawa was a mistake she made. In other words, as best I can tell from the evidence, and I'm happy to be corrected by anyone in the audience, Freeland's office contacted Robert Fife of the Globe and Mail and gave him the question to ask Freeland, for which she had a scripted answer typed out on the page of her briefing book in front of her. So if you look very carefully and blow up the imagery of this press conference, you see that she was prepared to answer Fife's question. Fife and the Globe and Mail played patsy to Miss Freeland. Why did she do that? She raised the story out of its obscurity 2 months earlier. It had appeared, begun to run in two months earlier. The history, the facts, the academic articles on Chomiak's disreputable, immoral, and murderous past were circulating for years, but within the Ukrainian community. Freeland felt under the gun, but she hasn't told anybody why. I believe it was that she knew she had trouble with the Prime Minister's office. The Prime Minister's office has had nothing whatsoever to say in support of Freeland throughout this affair. Fife and the Globe and Mail played patsy to a staged question, and Freeland gave a staged answer, which shocked everybody because it was so evasive. They weren't shocked by Robert Fife's evasive, opinionated, and prejudiced question. They were shocked by Freeland's answer. That was Freeland's miscalculation. And the rest, as we all say, is history. She compounded the mistake, and her allies in Maclean's and the Globe and Mail and the Toronto Star and so forth and so on, they all made it worse by beating her drum, the anti-Russian drum, without focusing on the realities. So it was a colossal mistake, and it bounced exactly in the wrong way. Mm. But underneath it all was whatever plot the foreign policy establishment have in Canada towards Freeland as the spokesman of Canadian interests. They began to fear, as I understand it, but by all means try to put Jeremy Kinsman, former Ambassador Kinsman, on, because he's one of the members of Trudeau's Foreign Policy Council who has yet to be promoted to a job. Several people on the council have been promoted to Trudeau jobs. Jeremy hasn't. But ask the question, are they satisfied with this Ukrainian-Canadian representing Canada's interest in the Ukraine the way she's been doing? That's that part of the story.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Commentator John Helmer has posited in a recent article that behind the scenes, the Foreign Policy Establishment of Canada and the PMO have concerns about the Foreign Affairs Minister's apparent lying about her grandfather's past and about a conversation she supposedly had with President Putin in November. Helmer also alluded to an effort to fend off a possible challenge by the ambitious Freeland to Trudeau's prime ministership. I probed Helmer further on these points. I guess my question to you, just echoing back what I think I'm hearing you saying, is that when Chrystia Freeland had, you know, set up that encounter with Bob Fyfe, or so you're theorizing, that it was basically an attempt to put the whole controversy on her terms, and so, you know, fending off a threat from within the foreign policy establishment. Do I have
that's right?
Yeah.
Yes, that's what happened. Ms. Freeland miscalculated. The Prime Minister's office and the Prime Minister's mother, both of whom have suspicions of Ms. Freeland's untrammeled, uncontrollable ambition, have yet to make any responses to Freeland's to Freeland as a threat to Justin Trudeau. So yes, I believe she felt Freeland thought it was coming, decided to make a preemptive attack, did it so badly, and Fyfe did it so stupidly, and the Globe and Mail was then followed by all the others. And she's now in a far worse off position than she would have been if she'd waited or remained silent. But she can't. She's got one of those egos that simply can't be stopped. And that ego isn't satisfied until it takes the prime ministry. And I think this is a scandal which will make sure she doesn't.
So, Roger, do you have any thoughts about that March 6th press conference?
Yeah, and I'll just remind listeners that what happened on March 6th was the minister was pitched a question about the reporting that had come out, beginning with John, of her maternal grandfather's rather dark history during World War II. And she simply evaded the question and turned it into another one of her typical anti-Russia diatribes, saying, oh, this is all just another example of Russian manipulation of public opinion taking place. And then she cited what's going on, the madness going on in the United States today, where apparently the whole country is being taken over by the Russian government, or at least the current administration. And this is another, I think, important, you know, just backdrop to the whole thing that's going on in Canada, which is, to have the minister commit such a blunder. Instead of simply answering the question, which would be, I'm not responsible for my grandfather's past, and in fact, I've spoken on written this in the past, end of question. Instead, she thinks that she can, put across to Canadians the same kind of anti-Russia propaganda campaign as we're seeing in the United States, alleging direct Russian intervention and manipulation in the Canadian political process. And the whole thing blew up in her face, and journalists in Canada had no choice but to report that the minister had committed a blunder and that it was an embarrassing act. So yeah, it was quite a remarkable thing, and I think among other things, the minister's action has opened the eyes to a lot of journalists who maybe didn't want to think about Ukraine and now kind of are obliged to do so. Let me add one other thing. Canada is increasing its intervention in the civil war in Ukraine. It's decided.
Yes, they increased or extended their intervention until 2019.
Extending their mission. And actually, we don't really know. We in Canada don't really know what the Canadian Armed Forces are actually doing in Ukraine. We know they're training the Ukrainian army and the paramilitary forces who are waging war in eastern Ukraine. But what's the extent of that training? Are Canadians present in eastern Ukraine itself? What about armaments? I mean, these are questions that Canadian journalists have been staying away from, and hopefully we can start having some scrutiny.
Yeah, I've got a whole bunch of questions that spring from those last comments you've made, but I guess I just wanted to echo that what I'm hearing as I speak with the two of you is that, or what I think I'm hearing, is that the Canadian government is determined to support this whole mythology around Ukraine and the Russian interference. And so that foreign policy is set. But the concerns with Freeland was that initially they thought, hey, here's somebody who's from the diaspora, very articulate, a journalist, a very you know, very outspoken and so on. And then of late, they've realized that they kind of created a bit of a monster and that this person isn't working out the way they thought. And then things are getting out of control. But the foreign policy is set. So is that kind of where you're...
Let me come in there, Michael. There's nothing wrong with your ears. You're hearing it right, but you hear, regrettably, this is not, you're not hearing enough evidence of what's happened. What's happening in, as Roger pointed out, is there's no information about what exactly this Canadian force is doing in the Ukraine. For one thing, the Canadian force of trainers in the Ukraine is commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Mark Lubinetsky. Guess where the Lubinetsky family comes from? If you poke into the history, probe into the history, read up on Lieutenant Colonel Mark Lubinetsky's family, you discover that they too, like Freeland, come from, guess where? The Western Ukraine. They've come home. Mark Lubinetsky was promoted to run the Canadian or command the Canadian trainer force in March. So he's a relatively recent appointment. The area where they're based, Starichi, is a village near Lvov. The nearby Yaroviv training ground for U.S. and Canadian forces to have little exercises with Ukrainian troops is also in the same region. And this was a region which was a killing ground of Poles and Jews by the Germans and the Ukrainians during World War II. Now you've got essentially the way I see it, the way Poles see it, the way Jewish people would see it, the way Russian speakers in the Ukraine would see it, is a tiny minority of Canadians have grabbed hold with Canadian taxpayer money of a military power in Western Ukraine to reestablish a regional minority of Ukrainians to run the country. And they are, in fact, taking over from the Kiev regime. So it would be interesting to have Lieutenant Colonel Lubinetsky talk in the Canadian media. He gave the keynote speech at a Ukrainian cadet graduation last week. Perhaps he should be invited to speak to Canadians. He carries a national Canadian passport. He's paid by Canadian taxpayers. Maybe he should be asked questions and answer Canadians, not Ukrainians. And then we could ask him Roger's question. Excuse me, sir, what are you doing with Canadian money there and why? And what do you know about the region? And how far has Canadian training of the locals extended to the protection of Polish cemeteries, Polish territory, Polish citizens, and Polish diplomatic establishment around the Ukraine? Has he trained Western Ukrainians, Galicians, to respect Poland? Or is he training people to fire rocket-propelled grenades into every Polish target they can find because there are no Jewish targets left? Those are questions Lieutenant Colonel Lubinetsky, representing Canada, should be answering to Canadian public opinion.
Okay. Roger?
Yeah, the tragedy in the whole situation in Ukraine is that a resolution of the conflict in the east of the country exists. It's called the Minsk II Peace Agreement. That was agreed to in February 2015 by Ukraine and Russia, by the rebel forces, what I call the pro-autonomy forces in eastern Ukraine, and Germany and France. The governments of Germany and France agreed to act as guarantors of the agreement. And it sets out a framework to basically bring Ukraine back to the time when it was a peaceful, multinational, and multilingual country. In fact, something of a model and example for other countries around the world. So it's there. It's available, but the government in Kyiv refuses to implement the peace agreement because they refuse to allow a decentralized Ukraine in which not just Donbass but other regions of the country would have autonomy, really not much different than the constitutional setup of Canada or, in fact, of Russia, where, you know, provincial governments in the case of Canada, republics in the case of Russia, have substantial economic, political, and cultural powers. It could be easy to implement. It doesn't require, you know, a radical shakeup. Except in the context of ultranationalist Ukraine, it is a radical shakeup. And so the government refuses to do it. And of course, breathing hard on the neck of the Ukrainian government is the minority, but extremely militant and now well-armed and trained extreme right minority in Ukraine. Even in Ukraine, it's a minority of ultranationalists who are pushing this war agenda, but they are heavily armed. They ideologically hold considerable sway over the country and over world opinion because of the default by so much of the world, especially the Western countries and media. So that's a big tragedy. And I'll add, we've already seen a peaceful resolution of one of the conflicts in Ukraine, which was the secession of Crimea. That was a peaceful event. People voted, and they voted overwhelmingly to, in their view, correct a decision made way back in 1954 by the Soviet Union. And despite the embargoes and the threats and everything else against Crimea since, we've seen a relatively peaceful and slowly emerging prosperous Crimea. So in both cases, there's the solution. What's the problem? It's this adherence to this right-wing Ukrainian ultranationalist ideology, which John is correct, has you know, it's always been in hold in Canada, but now it's almost like a death grip over the country's politics.
I would like to pick up on that whole idea of the ultranational, what you call the ultranationalist ideology. I think that for, you know, Canadians at least, as we look at Ukraine, I am curious to understand this, if there is a or the nature of a national identity, if it has that in the sense of a Russia or a Canada or a France or whatever. Because it sounds like there's a range of different sorts of nationalities within there, and like if there is any kind of a binding glue that holds it all together. And I think, you know, maybe, John, you could address that idea.
There's no glue holding Ukraine together. There are guns and Canadian taxpayer dollars. That's the glue, and it doesn't work. By normal standards, the Ukraine is not a country anymore. It can't tax its people. It can't regulate its borders. Its currency is run from the IMF in Washington, and the regime, the elected presidency of Poroshenko, can't do fundamentally obvious things that governments can do in normal countries. For example, the ultra-right troops have imposed a blockade on the Donbas against the policies of the Kiev government, its armed forces, its Minister of Economy, and its National Bank. That's going to cost the GDP of the Ukraine at least 1%. It cuts off coal and other energy resources from allegedly a part of its own country. So the East is cut off. Inside the in Kiev, the capital, a group of people can decide to dump huge concrete blocks in front of the doors of five major Ukrainian banks, which happen to be owned by the Russian state, by Alpha Bank, the Mikhail Friedman Group, and others, to prevent people doing business with the banks in which their deposits are held. That was an operation not by the government, but by a minority group, and it's forced the government to go through a procedure of apparently selling, obliging the Russian banks to sell to Ukrainians or to others. There is no police protection for diplomatic establishments in the Western Ukraine. So you can't, a government which can't enforce protection and security for diplomatic establishments, can't protect its currency, can't tax its people, can't control the supply of vital coal and energy resources from the east isn't a government at all. Mm-hmm. It's a puppet that has lost its strings.
I also wanted to bring up the reality of that Western region, the what they call the Galician region, and the unique threat as you see it, because that does seem to be the connection with Chrystia Freeland and that whole a lot of the elements of the Ukrainian nationalist influx from around the time of the war into Canada. That there was that specific region, and it seems to have be expressing itself outward. Is that something you can you've researched and can speak to?
Well, Roger can speak to the impact of the Galician mindset in Canada. What I can say at the moment is that the Polish government is increasingly concerned at the territorial expansion threats from that part of the Ukraine towards Poland. You've got to remember that once the Ukraine decided to orient itself to the European Union, it conceded the rights of Polish citizens who were dispossessed from 1939 to 45 to recover their property. So there have been bus tours of Polish descendants going to Western Ukraine and looking at the properties, the apartments, the buildings, the land, and so forth, which had belonged to their grandparents and who had been murdered by Mr. and Mrs. Czermak and their friends. So recovery of past is an active issue between Poland and Galicia. On the other side, there are the far-right groups who make claims to recovery of Polish towns along the border. And then there are demonstrations of one view or another by crowds of people picked up on Polish or West Ukrainian media, which emphasize how hot a local issue this is. Now, if you come back a minute and say that's really hot in the West, you've got an uncontrollable war, as Roger said, with a formula that Kiev, the Minsk formula that Kiev can't enforce its own troops to implement, and you come back to Ottawa, then you've got a policy establishment that says, whoa, Canada is an Arctic country, an American country. How much do we want to be dragged into that conflict, spend our millions and millions of taxpayer dollars on a conflict which is far, far away from Canada's national interests? Canada's an Arctic country. It has a border in the Arctic with Russia. Don't we have an interest not in going to war over Galicia with Russia, but don't we have an interest in seeing how much we can accommodate with Russia in the Arctic, and on and on and on.
Mm. Yeah, that might speak to something. Even just looking at, oh my gosh, I mean, from the foreign policy establishment of Canada would obviously recognize that and say, wait a second, the people of Canada may not be looking at this right now. I got other concerns, but if this does become in some sort of like a Canadian Vietnam or something like that, then that could start to really hurt them hard. Roger, you have a comment.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to your question about Ukraine and exactly what it is. You know, I call the situation today a tragedy because when you study Ukrainian history, I mean, it's a fascinating and glorious history. Here's a future peasant country during the 19th and early 20th century that fought the oppression of the Russian Tsarist regime and, arrived on the world scene in 1918 as an independent country. And then a very conscious policy that was pursued by the leaders of the early Russian Revolution to constitute a viable country and even nation, although I use the term nation in a certain type of form that's not typically used, because what emerged in Ukraine was also not just a national entity and consciousness, but a Soviet entity and consciousness. And I don't think historians have really studied that sufficiently, because that's a very interesting development process. Ukraine had its difficulties in the Soviet Union from the 1930s onwards in continuing to affirm and develop its language, culture, history, all those sorts of things. A very complicated story that we can't really do here in any justice. But it survived and nonetheless prospered as a place. Then you had the second independence of Ukraine in 1991, and things went awry, because this was an independence that was, you know, lurching the country back, I would argue, backwards into capitalist economic development, and that was unsuccessful in Ukraine. In contrast to Russia, which, along with its oil and gas wealth, but also its human wealth and potential, Russia prospered in the 2000s, the years of the 2000s. Ukraine didn't. Ukraine remained stagnant economically throughout its period of second independence. And this is what led to all of the mass discontent that we saw in the streets of Ukraine in 2013 and 14, where people thought that making an abrupt shift away from economic association with Russia towards Europe, what I call austerity Europe, was going to save the country and save the economy. And it's done the opposite. Ukraine has suffered terribly in the last 3 years from this turn to austerity Europe. Social programs have been cut. Economic ties with Russia have been cut deliberately, purposely, that have harmed the Ukrainian people greatly. Hasn't harmed the elite. They've done well by more privatizations of public property, of currying favors with Europe. So it's a tragedy for the Ukrainian people, because what they have been establishing, I argue, is a good example and model for others in the world. In the time when Ukraine was the multinational and multilingual country, where it didn't matter so much if you spoke Russian or Ukrainian. So what? They're two important languages, and they can coexist. So I think one thing that's very important to do is historians have to go back to the books and study this, including, and I'll just throw this in as the last comment, this whole false historical myth of a genocide being perpetrated against the Ukrainian peasantry during the 1930s by the government of the Soviet Union from Moscow, what's called the Holodomor. We're talking the period 1931 to 33, when there were famines in the Soviet Union, in many areas of the Soviet Union, caused by drought conditions, the underdevelopment of agricultural science, the still underdeveloped technology of food production, and yes, perhaps, administrative decisions that went along with the industrialization of agriculture that was taking place and the radical change in land ownership forms towards collective or cooperative property forms. But this myth of a genocide being directed against the Ukrainian peasant population is a great historic injustice. It's not true. It didn't happen. There were famines in the Soviet Union itself. And so historians, I think, have a big job to do now to deepen the historic understanding of Ukraine and really bring out the best of the lessons and experiences, because I think it's been an extraordinary country and an extraordinary historical place that's been deeply distorted. The history itself has been deeply distorted by the ultranationalist ideology, and then by
that's
people
a,
who
it's
have,
a very contentious point in this country, as you know.
Is it ever? I mean, Holodomor is officially recognized by the Canadian government and at least four provincial governments that I know of. So it's a terrible injustice to history. That's a significant obstacle to reaching peace today in Ukraine, and peace with Russia and all of Eastern Europe.
John, do you have any concluding thoughts before we close?
Concluding thoughts. It sounds odd. You can hear my accent. Regrettably, I'm not Canadian. I've enjoyed particularly Montreal. I'm not particularly familiar with Toronto, and I've not really been to the West. So it's odd for the audience to listen to a guy like me with this accent trying to remind folks what is the Canadian national interest here. As Roger has pointed out, the Canadian Parliament is proving to be useless in having a debate about the different Canadian interests at stake. The debate on the extension of the military mission of Canada to the Ukraine a couple of weeks back in Ottawa is worth reading for what didn't happen. There wasn't a debate about what's the Canadian interest here. A tiny minority group, Ukrainians from the west of the Ukraine, with a particular historical grudge, as Roger has explained, have distorted Canadian policy and are using hundreds of millions of dollars of Canadian taxpayer money to do things which are not in Canada's interest. So what we're seeing under the rug here is Prime Minister Trudeau putting Minister Freeland in her place, reminding her that she is the Foreign Minister of Canada, not of Galicia. But there's no readiness of the Canadian mainstream press to say, hey, Mr. Prime Minister, what did you really mean here? Hey, what is the Canadian interest that Freeland represents? So she's been told, back down, keep your mouth shut, and meet with Mr. Lavrov and discuss what are Canada's real interests in the Arctic and elsewhere in the world. Good. That would be a start. So I'm hoping that your listeners can contact their MPs and say, how come your mouth was buttoned in Ottawa 2 weeks ago? Do you dare to stand up for Canada versus Galicia? Do you support Mr. Prime Minister's upstaging of the foreign minister? Who's the prime minister of this country? Those are questions I'd leave with your audience. And pardon me for being the foreigner who points it out, but sometimes one has to see the obvious from a long distance away. I recommend folks read Roger's website to keep up with the issues on the ground. But I'd like to see the appropriate committee in Ottawa call back Lieutenant Colonel Lyubinetsky and explain what his loyalties are in Western Ukraine, and which part of the multicultural society that once was the Ukraine does he represent, and how much Canadian money's been spent on whose blood on the Polish border. Those are the questions Canadians have to ask. If they don't want to ask them, stop spending money there.
Okay, John Helmer, Roger Annis, I'm afraid we have to close there, but thank you so much. It's been a very enlightening and interesting conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
We've been speaking with John Helmer, a foreign correspondent in Russia, and he is the host of the blog Dances with Bears at the site johnhelmer.net, and Roger Annis regularly writes on social justice and peace issues. He's one of the editors of newcoldwar.org. He also hosts the site rogerannis.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.